Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Professor Bart Rientes in this episode. Bart is Professor of Learning Analytics with the Open University UK, with an extensive and impressive list of publications related to the use of data to improve student outcomes. Bart and I talked in the Jenny Lee Building at the Open University's Milton Keynes campus. So I'm joined now by Professor Bart Rientes of the Open University UK. Bart's Professor of Learning Analytics with the IET, the Institute of Educational Technology, and he's doing some really interesting work with learning analytics. Bart, thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me.
Great. Bart, can you start off by giving us just a brief overview of your career and publications to date?
Where I can probably start is in Maastricht, where I started as a lecturer or an assistant lecturer in economics. Yeah, I never really imagined that eventually, 18 years down the line, I would be a professor of learning analytics. So when I was starting to teach in 2000, we didn't have those technologies. I remember very vividly that the business school I was working for at Maastricht University, in 2001, they had this amazing tool called Blackboard. And they said, yeah, if we implement that tool, that learning management system, everything will be radically different. Yeah. And I think one of the things that they did really well there is rather than buying the system and then top-down ask teachers and students to use it, they had this radical idea that for each department, they nominated one person to help to make sense of the tool and to make sense of the system in general. And by mere coincidence, because I think I was the webmaster at that point in time of the department's website, they asked me to do this. Mm-hmm. So there were these six or seven relatively young people who were thinking about this thing called educational technology. And initially we had no idea what it was, but slowly by working together with the IT infrastructure, but also to work together with actual teachers, it became a kind of, oh yeah, this could work, maybe we can supplement in Maastricht we use problem-based learning. Maybe we can supplement our problem-based learning phases by, for example, including discussion forums so that students, before they come to the group, they can already start to discuss some of the activities. Or when they are in the so-called post-discussion phase, they have like a track record of what they've discussed, and then they could at a later point in time go back to those discussions. Mm. And yeah, before I knew it, we implemented the system in the School of Business. And then suddenly, because none of the other faculties had this structure, they were like, oh yeah, let's do exactly the same as the School of Business. So it was quite interesting that the actual system, and I think it's still the same system as it is now, is basically developed by a couple of teachers who thought, okay, it might be good to have a standardized approach, or it might be good to always have discussion forums linked to a particular group. So we made lots of decisions based on collaborative discussions. And then I think in 2003, I got my first small internal grant to understand, okay, but if we implement the discussion forums, why do we typically see that then some students are very active and other students are not? Mm. And that was like pre-smartphones, so people had to go to the library, log in. Some did, some didn't. Most people at that time didn't have a laptop. So it's really interesting to start to think about these things. Yeah, slowly I started to attract a little bit more funding. We did our first online summer course at the Open University. We have these access courses. And in 2004, we thought, hey, but there are lots of students from all across the globe who want to come and study at Maastricht University, but they struggle in mathematics. But they also typically struggle to work in a problem-based learning settings, because it's kind of weird if you're coming from, let's say, Argentina, to suddenly talk with other peers. So we thought, oh, maybe if we design some kind of online course. And that's what we did. And surprisingly, there were lots of students signing up for this. And eventually, winding a little bit further, in 2006, I moved to the Department of Education, Research and Development, And then my professor at that time said, well, maybe you should write a PhD on the work you're doing. Mm-hmm. I was like, but what can I write a PhD on? It sounds like very, very weird and strange. But I quickly started to realize that how people engage in these online communities is fundamentally influenced by this magic group dynamics. And some groups really work well and others don't. And also even in groups that work really well, you can see that some students are very active and others seem to be what later is called lurking. And so eventually I wrote my PhD on that, which is something which I didn't really imagine that I would do. And if I wind the clock a little bit further forwards, in 2010, we made a decision to move to the UK. And I first started to work at University of Surrey, where I was involved in teacher education. So how can we teach teachers to improve their learning design, and how can we help them to engage in an exciting lecture or how to design assessment? So I left technology for a little bit because that was not the core focus. But at the same time, I learned a lot about how teachers learn, which is very exciting. Mm. Yeah, in 2014, I came here at the lovely Open University. And God, it's 2018, close to 2019, and I'm still here.
So it sounds as though, for you, I mean, obviously your background in economics made you very confident with numbers and trends and how to interpret those. Your subsequent work with learning design would have been quite important too in terms of where your career's gone. It seems now that you're actually fusing those two things together.
Yeah, and I think what I've also really learned in the work at University of Surrey, I was the only quant person, the only quantitative person with 12 hardcore qualitative people. So initially we really were on completely different planets. But eventually we also managed to write a couple of papers together, because it is really interesting from the kind of big numbers. Mm. You can then start to ask really fundamental questions about not only what is happening, but also why and how is this happening. So I've learned a lot in those 3 years at Surrey about how to use particular mixed methods approaches to really unpack the complex learning processes. So it's an interesting journey.
So what was your thesis actually about?
It was about understanding the social interactions in computer-supported collaborative learning. And I was particularly interested in the role of motivation. So what I saw in those groups, if you use social network analysis, you could see that some students became very central and other students were not very central in that network. But I couldn't really understand why is it that some people become central and others not. So we linked this with the self-determination theory of Dashi and Ryan, who basically distinguish between intrinsically motivated students, that is students who really enjoy study economics, who really want to deeply understand, versus the extrinsically motivated students who study economics because their mom told them to do so, or their dad says, you're going to be really rich if you study economics. So more externally focused. And what we found quite quickly, if we link those types of motivations to the interaction patterns, we found, in a way it's still magical, is that intrinsically motivated students who were studying all across the globe quite quickly realized that it's really nice to talk to Mark, or it's really nice to talk to John, but to talk to Bart, who was extrinsically motivated, it seems that the conversations didn't evolve in a natural way. So quite quickly, within the first week, we could see that there's a kind of core group of intrinsically motivated students who just kept on talking with each other. And then the extrinsically motivated students, the ones who, for example, wanted to make money or their parents thought it was good to study economics, they tried to come into that core of intrinsically motivated students, but it was really difficult to get into it. So eventually they also again drifted out of the conversations. So it's the metaphor that I use was it's a kind of a peach. There's like a really hardcore group of people who continuously are engaging, but on the outside, it's quite difficult to get into that course. And I think in a way that it links very well to the kind of learning design approach, because we, since 2004, because we saw that for 8, 9, 10 years, the same pattern occurring all the time, so we continuously try to change the learning design in such a way that we try to encourage those extrinsically motivated students to become part of the core.
Yeah, yeah.
And most of the times that failed. But I guess that's why we also do research. And it's exciting.
Mm. Brilliant. Thanks, Bart. So, Bart, can you tell us a bit about the ideas and themes that your work has provided? I've got here on the question that you sense is still pertinent today, but most of your work's quite recent. So I'd imagine a lot of it will still be very, very relevant.
I'm a bit of a chameleon. My hobby horse is internationalization. So I do a lot of research in my free time on internationalization. In terms of learning analytics, I think that the holy grail, in a way, we discovered, but discovered is perhaps a little bit over-exaggerated, is we've seen quite early in our research at Maastricht University that just looking at clicking behavior of students provides very limited insight in terms of actual learning. We've seen that a student has clicked 100 times on a web page. That 100 times could be just a cat sitting on a computer keyboard, or it could be that a student is completely lost. Or it is that a student is deeply engaged or is continuously scrolling but doesn't really get the point. So the fundamental question of engagement is a really complex concept because you don't know what the student is actually doing. So I think one of the ideas that will continuously be linked with my work is the link between learning design and learning analytics. So once you see patterns in terms of engagement of data and marry that up with, okay, to what extent does that engagement pattern link with what a teacher has intended? Then you can start to see, hey, I see difference in peaks and troughs, I see difference in engagement. There could be hundreds of reasons why there's a difference, but that gives a kind of framework to see to what extent are students following a particular pathway. If you take a metaphor of a sat nav, yes, you can drive from Milton Keynes to London in many different ways. And if there is no roads, if you would fly like a helicopter, you can go in hundreds of different ways. But I think what learning design gives you the opportunity is to see, okay, there are a couple of major routes you could take. And then we can see, okay, which students are taking the easy route, the M1 route, or which students take a slightly more scenic route, or which students are driving slightly faster, which ones are driving slightly slower. So in a way, what you're trying to get at is, okay, to what extent do these decisions that students make in terms of their engagement link with how the course is designed? And I think it's really insightful. It was such a powerful predictor for how students are progressing over time.
Mm. So what are some of the major lessons from that based on learning activities and student engagement? Yeah. What can you tell us?
So on the one hand, we all know that design of learning or learning science is incredibly important. The number one lesson in a way is it's the key driver for learning. So we find that in our analysis across 38 modules, we found that 69% of weekly engagement by students is determined by how we design our courses. Mm-hmm. So if you think about this, it's a tremendous figure because it means that 2/3 of all the learning that takes place across our hundreds and thousands of students is determined by us, the Open University. So occasionally when I'm in meetings, we have a tendency to blame the student for retention issues or for not getting the materials or for not engaging online or for not posting interesting discussions in a discussion forum. But our analysis show that 69% of the pathways that our students are taking are determined how we as teachers design those courses. And we have amazing course at the OU where we can see that students really transition very nicely on that route. And at the same time, we have lots of modules where we make it really hard for our students. So I think the real insight in a way in this narrative is, okay, how can we visualize those complex journeys, both to students and to teachers? And hopefully in the next 5 years, this will become a really powerful tool in a daily practice because a lot of research we do is research-driven, is internally driven, and we can show, oh, there's a link, a causal link between A, B, and C. But of course, changing ABC is an even harder challenge.
So 69% of our student success is determined by the learning design of the modules that we put into it.
Yeah.
I think then for online learning, the main lesson is it's not so much the technology, it's not so much, to some extent, even a tutorial role. It's how you actually design the module itself.
And then, of course, the key question is, what's the optimum design? And I think what is really interesting in a way is there is not a kind of one single universal design that works for all disciplines. But what we do see is that the way how teachers, let's just take one particular program in computing, we can see that how teachers in computing design courses fundamentally influences how our students are behaving. And we can also see in terms of retention that this is a key driver for retention. So we can see that if in computing courses students have to, whether they like it or not, have to work together, they become more engaged when they work on more authentic tasks, when they're programming something, then yes, that is hard. But eventually we see that they are more likely to continue following the course and thus also successfully pass through their qualification. While in other modules where we're literally just throwing stuff to them, this is how you program in R, this is how you program in Java, of course, the proof is always doing it yourself. And I think that is in a way fascinating. The next step would, of course, be is, okay, what's the ultimate recipe for designing a year one computer programming course in Java? Or what would be the number one recipe for designing a course in English language? And I guess that's where we're currently merging all that insight from learning analytics with learning design, but without a teacher and the teacher reflecting on those designs and data and without the student, it's just numbers. So we really need to kind of triangulate those different perspectives.
So learning design then is a really important indicator of student success and outcomes. Mm-hmm. There's no single way of doing it. It does depend on the discipline, a whole lot of other contextual factors. So it's been commonly remarked that online learning has 20% less retention than face-to-face teaching. What would you comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I remember talking about inspirations. I met Martin Falke in 2006 when I was still an economist and working a little bit with education. And then he said something which really had a big influence on me. He basically said, I'm not interested whether face-to-face is better than online or how much percentages it's better or worse. He says, I think it's essential that we investigate under which conditions, under which frameworks, with which tools does a particular approach work for a particular group of students. Yeah. When, of course, you're 18 and you directly came from high school and you have the opportunity to go to Cambridge or to Oxford, or you can go to the Open University, of course, I would recommend people actually to go to Cambridge and Oxford or to any other university, because the experience of face-to-face and the experience of interaction, that is part of the culture of the university, but many of our students don't have those opportunities. And then the Open University provides this completely different community. So I think you're not comparing like for like, you're comparing completely different kettles of fish, buses and cigarettes, as I sometimes say. So it is all about, okay, how can we maximize the learning design given our students, rather than asking, is face-to-face better than online learning?
Yeah, but it's now coming towards the end of 2018. So what are your observations about online learning and education at the present time?
If you would have asked me this question 10 years ago, I would have said, oh, it's going to radically change higher education and all universities will step into that place and we will have really amazing interactive courses where people have personalized learning paths, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Today, it's like, okay, if we, for example, look at the Open University, but also many other distance learning providers, it's still relatively traditional. You have a linear structure. Everyone has to follow more or less the same program. And yes, we are a little bit smarter in terms of seeing, okay, which designs work well for which types of students. And we have a little bit of analytics to signal to teachers which students might be struggling, which students might be doing well. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the core, most distance education is still relatively traditional. And if you look at an iPhone from 10 years ago, or if you look at where we are with social media now, I think they're, and you would draw a graph over time, you would still see that we're very conservative in our approach in comparison to other technologies that were big in 2008. So in that sense, I think there is still a big opportunity for us to be more innovative.
So what would you like to see? What do you think are the next steps for taking online learning forward?
Well, of course, the big word is personalization, and personalization not in the way how it was imagined in 2008, where we would design artificial intelligence routes based on what we as teachers think is the best route from A to B. But we can see from our big data that certain pathways are really useful for some students but not for others. So why not use that data to provide more personalized services to a student? So use personalization from a kind of student's perspective rather than, oh, let's design 5 different versions of Introduction to Programming and then let's hope that one of those 5 might work for a particular group of students. So I found it, we're in a kind of ultimate crossroad where we can see from the data which pathways might be successful, but we need to make that transition from seeing a particular trend to actually helping the students and teachers to use that information to allow them to take those different pathways.
Yeah, there are pathways within each module, within each course.
Oh, across basically the entire student's learning journey. So one of the biggest other big data that we found, and I'm now slightly moving away from learning design, but it is in a way linked to learning design, is how our students are progressing through the qualification is heavily influenced on how well the designs of each module link together in a qualification. And if you don't provide a consistent approach across a qualification, we see that many students then struggle. They were very successful in, let's say, Introduction to Programming, but then they go to a slightly different course which doesn't involve a lot of programming and doesn't involve a lot of hand-holding, very theoretical, for example, say, and then suddenly the same students did really well in the first course then eventually drop out because they find it too theoretical. Or vice versa, some students might want to have a more kind of academic course and then find the kind of pragmatic programming too difficult. So I think what we're not very good at is catching a kind of journey to our students, but then also, hey, if you're slightly on a different path, hey, here are 4 other routes that you could take and that would fit more closer to your interest. That is a big challenge that we haven't really addressed.
Can I pick up on consistency for a while? Because it's a very interesting theme, I think, for learning design and also online learning. So by consistency, you mean a module being shaped essentially the same way. So not necessarily cookie cutter, but having the same sort of basic approach. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, so I have to say I'm, of course, heavily influenced by my own past. So my own past in problem-based learning, every course, whether you wanted it or not, had to use the principles of problem-based learning. And, of course, the tasks that you were doing were, when you were teaching microeconomics, were different from macroeconomics. When you were teaching marketing, they were different from nursing, etc. But the underlying pedagogy was more or less the same, and the kind of structure of approach was more or less the same. And what I noticed was that once students get familiar with the approach, then in a way they also, of course, develop coping strategies with that approach and become more successful. Here, and as in many other distance universities, we basically provide a lot of freedom to our staff to be innovative, which is great. But if you have radically different designs over time, it requires a very careful management of expectations to the students. So if you've started with a very interactive course and the next course is a lot of assessment and the next course afterwards is a lot of hands-on productive activities, but we don't say this to the students, then of course they have to figure it out as they go along. And I think that's a very big ask for our students. So we also do see in qualifications that provide the kind of more consistent approach over time, we see that those students are progressing better than in qualifications where, in a way, you have to figure out what the design is. And it's, for some students, it's actually quite nice to continuously have change. But for others, it might just be that additional hurdle while they're juggling already so many things at the same time in their own private lives.
Yeah, so it's like having a sort of like a core pedagogical philosophy which goes across different modules, so students aren't learning how to learn each time.
Yeah, and it's interesting, for example, in Surrey, they don't have the same pedagogy in their courses, but what they do has is the number one focus is on, let's call it, employment. So in a way, all the courses that students follow, there's always a link to employment. So no matter what the pedagogical approach is, you can see there is something that eventually drives the students. So students are also selecting those universities like Surrey or Maastricht based on the kind of core focus. While the Open University by its nature is open, but open doesn't necessarily give you a kind of sense of direction of, okay, you will get a particular degree focused on X. So I think no matter what we eventually decide to do in terms of providing a clearer pathway, we have to just be very articulate in terms of the reason why we designed this pedagogy is because we eventually want you to become a graduate that, and that I think we need to be, articulate much clearer to and with our students.
Yeah, so it's linking the pedagogy with the learning outcomes, which is basically learning design 101, isn't it?
Yeah.
It sort of links us in quite nicely to the next question, which is, what research would you most like to see done at the moment?
So one of the things we notice is that over the last 40 or 50 years of the Open University is a tremendous richness of understanding of distance learning education within the OU. And when we were trying to provide evidence of what really works, what is the best way to design an assessment, or what is the best way to run an online session in a chat room, what we found that there was a lot of really good anecdotal evidence or lived experience evidence or action research. Oh, I've done this and this and this in my course and it seems to work really well. And in the last 20 years, I think we as researchers have not really done ourselves a lot of favors by only sticking to this. I think it's really important to have those conversations and to write up what have you learned in a course and what have you learned in a particular element within the module. I think what is really missing is a kind of evidence-based approach. If we better understand why we're designing a particular module, then we can start to understand, okay, why does it work or why does it not work? So I think what I'm hoping researchers will do is to think about, well, maybe we could introduce a control group and maybe we can see maybe the approach that we designed to the best of our abilities is actually not the best course of action for our students. And in educational research, you do see this kind of more learning science research, this more kind of evidence-based approach is being adopted in primary and secondary education. But in higher education, it's still more an art rather than a science.
So a shift away from evaluative research, more into experimental.
Yes, and I appreciate that many people will be hesitant to do this. As a slight side note, yesterday I watched an amazing documentary, it was called Horizon, where they gave patients a placebo of basically a new medicine that might help them to cure their back pains. And surprisingly, after the first 2 or 3 days, they did it with 100 people, and they didn't know that they received a placebo. Nothing happened, but after a couple of weeks, eventually they really started to believe in it, and approximately 45% of the people who were given a placebo were basically thinking and also expressing that their back pain disappeared. So what is fantastic in this kind of setting is that you can then start to prove, hey, just by giving a little bit of care to a patient and just by giving them something, you can already start to help them. And the metaphor in a way which I'm trying to make is, but if you of course then have a control group, you would never really know how effective this approach is relative to something else. So imagine if you would not give only a placebo, but if you would actually give a real intervention and then start to see what the impact would be. Yes, I appreciate there are lots of ethical implications, but my counter argument, if 50% of our students are failing in certain modules, then in a way we're, this is, for me, the biggest ethical issue. We know that a particular approach doesn't work for the half of our students, so why not try something radically different, have a good control group, and if we then quickly find out, oh, actually, even if it's just a 2 or 3 or 5% improvement, we could still save many students. And if it doesn't work, well, then I will be the first one to say, okay, it is a mistake, but at least we know that that particular approach doesn't work.
So just for clarity, on the Horizon program you watched, it was just placebo, there was no control group.
Well, the control group was basically they both gave two groups of people the same placebo effect, but one group thought they received something special and the other one, they were not sure about whether they what they received. What they both didn't know that they were both in the placebo group. And all of them thought with basically pre-post test that, or not all, 45% of the participants indicated that they radically improved medical and mental state, although it was just powder made out of rice, I think, so there's actually no benefit whatsoever. But it shows in a way how important doing good evidence-based research is.
Mm. I'd imagine some scholarship is potentially designed after the event. So yeah. Sometimes we do decide to write up our evaluation because we hadn't thought about it earlier.
Yeah,
we hadn't applied a deliberate approach to it.
Yeah, and I'm absolutely not saying that scholarship is bad. I think we're writing papers together as well, where scholarship is really good as reflective practice. Yeah. But I think what we've learned from our test and learn research and our evidence hub that we generated, there are hundreds and literally hundreds of articles written by the Open University and amazing scholars here who, in a way, primarily scratch the surface of what's happening in learning and teaching. But I would really like to know the underlying mechanisms of why a particular learning design works for some students and not for others, coming back to Martin Falco, who, in a way, it's not only about what works, it's about why do things work.
So, Bert, you've come a long way in terms of your leadership in online learning. Your career's obviously spanned 20 years. You've done some really interesting work in learning analytics more recently, but a lot more before that. Who are two people you'd recommend as leaders or legends of online learning? People who perhaps have influenced you or whose work you admire at the moment?
I mean, I think in a way, I have to say Paul Kirchner is probably a great inspiration. So he has been doing research in the last 40 years where he continuously has basically banged on the need for more evidence-based research. Mm. But evidence-based research strongly informed by learning science. So have a good theory that is tested, have good, clear hypothesis, then test it in an appropriate way and then see to what extent that theory actually holds or not, and then trying to identify under which conditions does it work and on which conditions doesn't it really work. And I think that in a way, that way of thinking, which is not always very popular, I think really helped us to get to the nuts and bolts of why do certain activities work and others not. So for example, his research on cognitive load clearly shows that there's only a certain amount of activities that you can do before people become overwhelmed. Yeah. And his groundbreaking work on instructional design clearly highlight, in a way very similar to our learning design research, that how we design our activities fundamentally influences what our students are doing. So that's one. He probably won't like it if I call him this, but my second dad, as I call him, and my partner in crime, Derek Templar, he is quite interestingly, he's an econometrician, but very interested in the kind of deep learning processes and deep psychological processes that students go through when they're working in blended or online environments. And over the last 25 years, he continuously has tinkered with his mathematics designs and continuously fine-proofed it. And some of the things he had been doing 15 years ago, we still don't do here, but he has already had kind of personalized learning journeys and feedback to students by dashboards in 2006, and then linking it to personal dispositions. But in a way, he's not as famous as the big other people that you've interviewed, but I think it highlights also a little bit his character. He's a kind of problem solver of small things, and in a way he's undervalued for his intellectual contribution, because as soon as he solved the problem, he will go to a next problem. Well, perhaps maybe in hindsight, if he would have stuck with that problem for 10 or 15 years, he would be the world guru in that particular one problem. So sometimes we also underestimate people who continuously come up with new ideas. And who knows, maybe one day people will give him the recognition he deserves.
Well, Bert, thank you for taking the time to share what's made you a leader in online learning.
I doubt that.
It's been a really interesting conversation. Very good to hear the link between learning design and analytics and student outcomes, which I think is quite a powerful theme for practitioners of online learning at the moment.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Fantastic. Thanks, Bert.
You can learn more about Bart and link to some of his publications from our website. His Twitter handle is Dr. Bart Rientes. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.